If you are a new listener, or maybe perhaps you've just been in a whiskey-induced coma over the last 2 years, by the way, that's fine. We don't judge people here on this podcast. One of the things that you may not know is that one of the topics we often talk about on this podcast, if you've funneled in from one of the other recent podcasts, is Tesla. We are skeptics. By we, I mean me and the guests that I have on. We are skeptics of what Elon Musk is doing. We are skeptics of how he is conducting business in the public markets. And we have done a litany of podcasts on the issue. And today we're going to go further down that rabbit hole and talk about why we think Elon Musk is generally full of shit. Before we get started, this is the QTR Podcast. Today's podcast is brought to you by my patrons. Patrons are people that sign up through Patreon and donate a monthly recurring sum to help support the podcast. This podcast does not happen without my patrons. Thank you guys very much for those of you who have signed up. I want to shout out some of my patrons and then we'll get started. First and foremost, my friend Pete over at thetraderspath.com. The Traders Path is a brand new day trader service. It offers investor education, investor advocacy, daily watch lists, live streams of day trading. If you are a day trader, you're trying to get an education, this is a great place to start. It was started by a gentleman named Pete, who I have talked to extensively, who I think is a good guy, who got tired of bullshit day trading services that you see advertised out there on YouTube, Facebook, etc., and said, you know what, I'm going to start my own trading service, one that is less full of shit. And so that is what the Trader's Path is. Link to that is in my podcast description. Check them out. Tell Pete I sent you. Ask him for a deal. Tell him, hey, Pete, I got a fucking guy, huh? You know, your guy sent me. Also, this podcast brought to you by my friends over at the Sang Lucci Steam Room. The Sang Lucci Trading Group are some of the sharpest guys on Wall Street. They are experts in following options flow to help determine where equities may be headed in the future. They are experts in tape reading. They are experts in market psychology. I have known these guys for 7 or 8 years. Sang Lucci and Charlie Bathgate, I consider them to be friends of mine. I have no problem giving their service the accolades that I believe they deserve on this podcast. They have a couple of things going on right now. If you head to the podcast description, you can check out their master course, which is going to give you an education on tape reading, options flow, market psychology, and they just released something called the 3LT Playbook, which is Lucci's three rules of trading that he has used to personally make himself a seven-figure trader. Ladies and gentlemen, it's not a bullshit story. I know Lucci personally, and just for that, I'm going to make him pay for my drinks the next time we go out. Pretty sure he actually still owes me like $35 for a Jameson I bought him in Vegas 3 years ago. But Lucci, I'm going to let it slide, brother, because it's all love on this podcast. This podcast is also brought to you by Rumorhound. Rumorhound.ai is a brand new artificial intelligence-based service that is going to help you distinguish which rumors about mergers and acquisitions in the market are perhaps worth following and which ones are perhaps worth letting slide by and letting go. It looks at the financial viability of a potential merger or transaction. It looks at the source that the rumor comes from. It takes all types of data and it aggregates through its proprietary artificial intelligence platform and spits out an easy to read recommendation for you as to whether or not a rumor is maybe worth looking at further or maybe not worth looking at further. You could fit it on a fortune cookie. That's how easy it is to read. And if you have a short attention span like I do and you're a total degenerate and only have three seconds to read these things during the market trading day, Rumorhound might just be for you. So why not throw it in your tool belt of things that you can use during the day? Check them out. Sang Lucci and Rumorhound, both in the podcast description. The link's right there, folks. I typed this shit out. Ahref equals quotation, the whole nine yards. So all you have to do is click it. This podcast, finally, also brought to you by my friends over at Focused Compounding. Focused Compounding is a group of individuals. All they do is focus on niche areas of the market and trades that nobody, no analysts, nobody on Twitter, no individual traders have pointed out just yet. They are trying to come up with unique ideas for you. Check them out at FocusedCompounding.com and follow them on Twitter at FocusedCompound. Links are in the podcast description. This podcast also brought to you by my longtime patrons, people like my friends over at Hellebacon, who shoot machine guns out of helicopters in Texas, my friends at Corvus Gold, Piggly Wiggly, my buddy Russ Valenti, Matt Zimmer, Nicholas Parks, Nathan Michaud at Investors Underground and Traders for a Cause, Chris Bede, Ken R., and Chris Boas. You guys have been coming through for a while, and I appreciate the shit out of you guys. Those are the people to thank when you enjoy listening to the podcast. Finally, some of my newest patrons, Sherman McCall, Roy Nassarian, Dijon Roberson, Stephen G., David Greiner, and Paul Porter. And I want to throw it back to some patrons that have been with me for a while, like William Sumfest, my friend Aqua Bear, Flo Algo, Nicholas Sutton is still in the house, Chris Schaefer, the Texarkana Federal Reserve, I see you all the time, and some of my oldest patrons, man, guys like Tom Wysocki, Aiden Archer, Brendan Illis, Michael Kantowski, Robert Mizello, you guys have been with me for over a year, Craig Gordon and Boz Trading, you too, I appreciate you guys very much. All right, we're going to get started with our badass interview today. Two more little pieces of housekeeping. Just hold on to your shorts. I'm going to get them done real quick. Number one, this is not financial advice. Neither I nor Tesla Charts are making any financial recommendations here. Do your motherfucking research elsewhere. That's our motto on this podcast. Don't listen to me. Don't listen to my guests. Do your research on your own. We don't want to hear any praising when things go great. And I sure as fuck don't want to hear any complaints when things go wrong. Do your research elsewhere. I am not a financial advisor. I am not registered anywhere. That's it. Finally, ladies and gentlemen, you've probably already got to this by this point in the podcast, but there is a 2-drink minimum for this podcast. So take 2 to the face and let's get fucking started. Okay, I mentioned earlier in the introduction that we have been talking really Tesla skepticism for a long time on this podcast. So if you're new to the podcast, the man that I'm going to introduce to you right now is known only by his Twitter handle, and that is at Tesla Charts. I think right now he's one of the most well-known Tesla skeptics on Twitter and in the Tesla Q community, which if you're looking for Tesla skeptics on Twitter, just put in $TSLAQ and you'll find your fair share of them. I am super stoked to have him on. I had him on back in July, and he can probably speak more about his history than I can, but he is an expert in, happens to be an expert in solar panels as well. And since his last appearance on my podcast, as Shakespeare would say, the shitteth hath hitteth the faneth when it comes to solar panels. Walmart has sued Tesla for solar panels that have caught fire on its rooftops. Amazon, I think, has also reported that the same thing has been happening. And that part of the narrative, always kind of thought to have been a ticking time bomb, seems to be coming undone. So, Mr. Tesla Charts, how are you today on a Tuesday?
Hey, Chris, thanks. Thanks again for having me on. I was just thinking as we were getting ready to record this episode that in the past 7 days you've had on Ron Paul, a guy who proved that Hitler died in 1962, and a guy who tweets Excel charts on Twitter. So, I mean, you've really come a long way from the beginning of the podcast. But all kidding aside, it's really great to be back on. And we had a very long discussion the first time I was on about SolarCity, and so it's been interesting to see the news flow since then, which I would say is quite validating.
Yeah, I would say so. You know, with regard to the podcast, thank you. I appreciate that. Everybody has had something to say about the guests that I've had on, both good and bad, but I'm sticking to my original plan, brother, which is just bring on people I find interesting, and you're certainly one of those people. I actually tried to book you a couple weeks ago when this whole thing started happening, but very much like my friend Montana Skeptic, you're very calculated and very measured, and you said, "Hey, let's just see how it goes. Let me get my shit together," you know. So I was like, "All right," I left you alone for a couple weeks, and I'm happy to have you back.
Yeah, you know, it's important to see how the news plays out, as is often the case with this name. Things that should really matter most oftentimes don't, and then suddenly something that you think doesn't matter much begins to matter. And I feel like with the convergence of some legal action and then also some developments in real time, the SolarCity saga, you know, with all that's been published, is starting to become more and more important once again, which is interesting for me given my knowledge and my background.
Yeah, so I don't want to go back through everything we talked about in episode 135. My listeners, if you want to familiarize yourself, do like a prerequisite. You can listen to my first interview with Tesla Charts, which was 135 from July 28th. But I mean, let's talk about solar cells and let's talk about the Walmart lawsuit.
Yeah, I was thinking about how to approach this for your listeners, and recognizing that not everybody has spent a lot of time studying solar technology, I thought it'd be useful if I just give maybe a 3 or 4 minute really ground level, you know, background on how solar cells work and what's important about them, just to properly frame the context of that lawsuit and some other things. Is that all right?
I'll give you 3 to 4 hours if you want. Let's go, brother. Let's go.
I will take that long.
My listeners are drinking. You're drinking, you just told me. So let's fucking go there.
All right. So the first thing you need to know about solar technology is a really fundamental fact about electricity. And this is, you know, for the people that are familiar with this story, if it's a bit basic, but I think it's important to start at the beginning and then very quickly climb the ladder, the technology ladder. Turns out there are two forms of electricity. There's direct current and alternating current. And I'll give you an example of both. And it'll become apparent very quickly why this matters. If you put a battery in a flashlight and then you turn it on, you've closed a circuit, and the current in that flashlight is known as direct current, DC. It just flows around the circuit through the battery, through the light filament, heats up that filament, and produces the light. That's direct current. It turns out when you plug in a lamp into your home outlet, that's actually a different kind of electricity. Everybody's home is wired for what's known as alternating current, or AC. Doesn't really matter. You just need to know that two forms of electricity exist and they're different. So for alternating current, it turns out that the current flows in alternate directions very quickly. The frequency with which it flows back and forth is called hertz. It's 60 hertz in the U.S. I believe it's 55 hertz in the U.K., sort of standard electrical guidelines. And that's just a completely different kind of electricity. You might ask yourself, why are there two kinds of electricity? Direct current is seems very sensible. Alternating current arose out of the need to ship electricity over long distances. And it turns out that you could very easily transform alternating current to very high voltage and then ship it over long lines efficiently. And then through another transformer, bring it down to a more proper voltage for your home. And so primarily because alternating current is easy to ship over long distances via power lines, that's become the standard form of electricity that all homes use. I started with the distinction between direct current and alternating current because we all use alternating current in our homes, but it turns out that solar cells create direct current, or DC. So they create the type of electricity that's more analogous to a battery that you would put in a flashlight. And so if you have an array of solar panels on your home, one of the most important things is how do you convert that power from DC to AC? And the manner in which you do that sets a lot of things in motion that dictate the sort of complexities and quality of the install and whatnot. So if you have panels on your roof that are producing direct current, before you get to use it in your home, it has to pass through something called an inverter. And an inverter, as you might have guessed, converts direct current to alternating current so that you can then use it into your home or feed it back into the grid. Well, it turns out getting the inverter to work correctly is a big part of the challenge, and there's lots of ways you can do it. The most prominent way is all of these solar panels are strung together in sequence with wires and connectors. And then if they're strung together in series, the voltage aggregates across each panel. And by the time it gets to the inverter, it's pretty high voltage stuff. And then that inverter, one central box, converts it to AC. If you string them together to one central box in parallel, then it turns out that the voltage is the same, but the current aggregates. That's a nuance that doesn't matter. But in all things electricity, current is going to flow where there's the least resistance, and you want the current to flow where you want the current to flow. And so right away, you have a decision to make. Do you have a central inverter that collects all of the electricity from your panels? Or alternatively, there's another technology called microinverters, where each solar panel has its own little mini inverter attached to it. To my knowledge, SolarCity only did string with central inverters. Microinverters have some huge advantages, but they also have some challenges, not the least of which they're more expensive, a little more difficult to install. And so if Chris, you know, if QTR wants to put a big solar array on his roof, the first thing you have to do is work with a really intelligent, well-trained, certified electrician to do it properly. You want all of the wires to work, to not be exposed, to be tightened correctly. You want the right design. So for example, if you have a solar array with some shade, you know, part of your array might be affected by shade during the day. If you've set up your solar array such that it's connected in series, it's kind of like the Christmas light phenomenon where one bulb can really mess up with the entire flow of the electricity. And so these are the types of things that quickly become complex as a homeowner. And it's really, really important that the electrician does all of these things correctly. And the thing that I think where SolarCity sort of went wrong, at least in reading this Walmart lawsuit that we'll get into, they were motivated to do as many installs as they could, as quickly as they could. And it seems like, if the allegations in the plaintiff's brief are to be believed, they may have cut a few corners. So I'll stop there and see if you have any questions about the sort of basics. This fundamental need to convert from DC to AC drives the real complexity of the solar cell.
No, I think I'm I think I'm with you, right? And that was an Edison versus Tesla thing, right? The DC versus AC, right? So Tesla was actually the guy that invented alternating current. Is that right? Interestingly enough.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And, I mean, and so exactly. It's very simple to say, but complex to integrate.
Right. So then the key issue again here is taking the direct current from the solar panels and converting it into alternating current so that it can be used by your house, which is wired for alternating current, or fed back into the grid, which also is right. And so what you're explaining is that there's several options on the solar panels, all of which seem complex and need to work together in order to make that happen. And that seems like kind of the trickiest part of the install. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Well, you know, when people say, oh, I have a more efficient solar cell, or I want to make my solar cell cheaper, they're only really talking about a very small part of the overall cost, if you will, of installing and using solar technology on your roof. Labor, connectors, wires, planning, proper installation, and really importantly, maintenance of that installation, making sure there's no hotspots, et cetera, become a really, really important part of the equation. Now, what's really interesting is how did companies like SolarCity and Run Solar, or Sunrun, I guess it is, come to exist? Well, it turns out that the Obama administration was very interested in catalyzing the wide-scale adoption of solar technology. And as is the case with most government desires, they set up a tax structure to try to increased demand for solar. Right. And of course, they had unintended consequences.
Of course.
If central planning worked, we'd all be celebrating May Day. So they passed this law that enabled third-party owners to receive the tax credit for a solar install. And that led to an explosion of companies like SolarCity fighting each other to try to get as many solar panels installed on residential and commercial scale projects as possible. So let me give you a real example. The big problem with getting solar propagated on at scale is the cost. And so to get a reasonably sized, you know, let's say 5 kilowatt type solar array up and running on your roof might cost you $20,000-$25,000. And the vast majority of American consumers aren't going to pay $25,000 to put a solar array on their homes. But with the passage of the tax credit scheme, companies like SolarCity and their competitors, to be fair, there's nothing specifically nefarious about SolarCity's business model. This was widely adopted across the industry. If you wanted to get a solar cell on your roof, SolarCity would call you and say, we'll do that, no money down. And all you have to do is sign right here where the line is dotted. And for the next 20 years, this solar cell will create electricity. You'll pay us a fee that they claim is less than what you would have paid to your power provider. But then SolarCity keeps the tax credit. And then SolarCity also has a stream of future payments that they could securitize. And so the business model that evolved from that tax law change was sort of solar leases or no money down leases, where all you had to do was sign a contract and they would take care of everything else. They would pay to have the solar cells acquired. They would arrange for oftentimes third party contractors to come and install it properly on your home. You would then begin to pay them every month for some portion of your electricity bill. The nature of those payments changed. Sometimes they escalated, sometimes they were fixed. Those are all contract specific details. But then immediately, SolarCity gets the benefit of the tax credit. Now you might ask yourself, what's the asset worth that tax credit? Well, it turns out they would then go ahead and funnel these tax credits to wealthy investors who had offsetting gains that they needed to lower their taxes for.
Right.
And so actually SolarCity for the longest time didn't make solar cells. They're trying to now in Buffalo. They weren't actually shouldn't think of them as a green energy or a solar technology company. They're actually one of the more sophisticated financial engineering companies out there. And their existence, the purpose of their existence is to take tax credits from people that would have normally received them for buying the system outright, and then connecting those tax credits to wealthy investors who have taxable gains that they'd like to offset.
And the amount that homeowners would pay SolarCity, was that predicated on the amount that they were supposedly saving? Was that supposed to be like a percentage of what they were saving?
So they were, I mean, that depends on the consumer and their layout and how big of an array they got. They're sort of power purchase agreements is the way to think of them. They would agree to purchase power for a minimum fee to SolarCity over 20 years. And so this is complicated enough, but you know, the big catch or the big lure for Chris, who wants to put solar cells on his newly built home and he wants to be green, is that there's no money down.
Right.
And so
This kind of like remarkable kind of, you know, annuity that on the top of your house that they're going to maintain, they're going to install, and basically, you know, it's like feels like a huge win for the consumer, right?
Well, the value share is an interesting question and a complex one, and depends a lot on a lot of assumptions, like what is the rate at which your traditional power company will raise your electricity rates?
Right.
What is the rate at which you have an escalating payment to SolarCity if you have one, and so on. So it's actually not clear to me that it was accretive to consumers. Another big assumption you have to make is, what is the discount factor on future payments?
Right.
What are interest rates going to do over this 20-year time period? I'm sure for many consumers, it might break even or make a little bit of financial value for them. But there's also a lot of complexity that comes with it. And it's not sure to me that when you correct for that complexity, whether it's truly accretive to the consumer.
Right.
Here's one simple complexity. If you leased a solar array with a 20-year commitment, that actually sticks with the home. And so if you sell the home, any prospective buyer has to take, you know, they have to assume the obligations that come with the lease, because the lease is to the property. And there are numerous instances of consumers facing difficulty selling their homes because essentially this solar array becomes a lien on their property. So if I wanted to buy your home, if you're moving from, you know, downtown Philly to the western suburbs because the podcast has taken off and you want a bigger place, I would have to assume the remainder of that lease, or else, you know, they have a lien on the property. So the bank wouldn't lend me the money to buy the home unless we cleared up that lien.
What a mess. Between that and then what it sounds like trying to figure out all the mechanics of whether or not it'll be accretive. I mean, yeah. It sounds like a fucking disaster that the average Joe isn't going to sit down and be running discount models, right?
Yeah. So I don't want to make it sound like the entire industry or even the majority of SolarCity installs are disasters. Mm-hmm. I'm just explaining the layout of
sure.
what then I think becomes the pressure point, which is when you lay over a stock promotion objective on top of all of this messy transaction, very complex financial engineering with a, you know, veneer of green global warming, rah-rah. If you have a strong desire to show growth to the market and promote your stock and get the stock price up and you're an insider and just, pledged a bunch of your stock for loans and are highly motivated to make sure that the stock doesn't go down, you very quickly get into a situation where your sales force can be motivated to get as many signatures on the line that is sure. dotted as possible, regardless of whether or not it makes sense for the consumer. And the sales force might emphasize things that are incorrect or might not emphasize things that are critical that would make a consumer decide not to go that way. And so you open yourself up much in any industry. Same with pharmaceuticals, you know.
Sure, yep.
You know, if the sales force is highly motivated and compensated on commission, they might get doctors to prescribe drugs where they're not needed. This is not a new thing. This is basically the fundamental problem with commission-based sales forces.
Right, right. And anybody that's ever walked into a Best Buy over the last yeah. 2.5 years where they had the SolarCity representative in there knows yeah. that those people are fucking thirsty, man.
They're motivated.
They hone in on you. I felt like body checking a couple of
right.
them.
And not all companies do that, and not all salespeople are that way. And so you don't want to make the outliers seem like the norm. Mm-hmm. But
correct.
That all leads us to the Walmart case, which is really an amazing thing. And for your listeners who aren't familiar, a corporate dispute over a total of 244 installs on various Walmart facilities has recently boiled over into a very public legal situation where Walmart has sued Tesla, i.e. SolarCity, for what it claims is a breach of contract over what it claims is undeniable gross negligence around these installs. And when you read the plaintiff's brief, which is always a dangerous thing to do, you know, I tried to read everything in the case, but the plaintiff's briefs, which is the brief that Walmart wrote to convince the court that, you know, Tesla had done it wrong.
Right.
It's a really stunning brief. You would think that if you're SolarCity, a very high-profile client like Walmart would be one that you would give extra attention to.
Right.
That you would take extra good care of.
Right.
That you would be willing to lose money on that contract to take good care of them, because of the brand and the brand risk that not taking care of a client like that would represent. In my old life, I had done a fair bit of business with Walmart, and I could tell you that they're very tough. Walmart's differentiating attribute is its ability to manage suppliers very effectively. To get into Walmart is really hard. You have to be an excellent supplier. They'll fire you in a heartbeat. But they're also very fair. They pay their bills. They're honorable business people, in my experience. And they have a certain set of expectations. And if you agree to those expectations, they will honor their side of the contract. And if you don't agree to those expectations, they will hold you accountable. There's zero chance, in my opinion, that the Walmart SolarCity deal happened without very high level executive engagement and promises on the SolarCity side, assurances. And I think when you read the lawsuit, it's very clear that Walmart at least feels like if they could do it over again, they wouldn't have gotten into this deal. So when you read the lawsuit, what you find is Walmart is accusing, again, it's all just accusations and a plaintiff's brief, and I want to be fair. But when you read it and you look at the pictures and you look at the correspondence between the companies, it's really stunning just how sloppily and dangerously it appears that these solar cells were installed on Walmart roofs. And the ultimate proof is of the 244, they've had 7 fires. which is a really amazing number. And most amazingly, they had four fires in the span of 54 days. And so after the bout of fires, Walmart, you know, because Walmart isn't in the solar business, they would like to have, you know, the reputational enhancement that comes with creating most of their electricity from green sources. And you understand why they would want to do that.
Sure.
But in reality, Walmart is there to sell cheap stuff at a reasonable profit to the average consumer. And when there's a fire on top of your roof and you have to, it was three fires in 50 days. I want to be fair to SolarCity. I want to get it right. It was only three fires in 50 days, not four. But if you have to empty your store and repair your store and lose 6, 7, 8, 9 days of sales and the reputational damage that comes from your store catching on fire, this far outweighs any potential benefit, either financial, environmental, or brand that would come from engaging in such a contract with a company like SolarCity. And when you read that lawsuit, the plaintiff's brief, you see all of the problems that you would think, oh my God, if that ever happened in my home, I'd be horrified. So, you know, loose wires, connectors not properly torqued, hotspots undetected. You know, and these things are a 20-year commitment to maintain these things when they arranged this contract. If they're seeing these types of problems now, what are the odds that there aren't major other problems elsewhere? And then, of course, in the brief, Walmart inspected something like 29 sites, and 27 of them had major issues. And Tesla also agreed, I guess, apparently, it participated in those inspections and so couldn't deny it. So if they're doing that with Walmart, what's going on at Chris's house? What's the inverter connections look like? Is there a hotspot? A hotspot is nothing more than what happens when a ton of current tries to go through a place of high resistance and gets super hot while doing so.
Right.
That hotspot could eventually start a fire. And so I would just say you need to think of a solar panel install on your home as a major electrical project that requires a licensed electrician of high competence that knows what they're doing, that's very careful, that follows the rules, that follows all the codes. It's not just some guy from Brooklyn that you're going to hire who's taking cash under the table.
Yeah.
to jerry-rig your solar panels and everything's just going to be great for 20
right.
years.
It's
just not how
not
it
installing
works.
A weather vane on the top of the house.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, I'm not going to put a black market a dish so I can get free cable on my roof. This is a wholly different exercise, which is why I was so surprised, you know, when I saw the solar reveal, because we could talk about that. But this is a really major thing. And you could see very quickly if you have enough arrays and they have different levels of shade and how you decide to set it up and are they in series or are they in parallel and are you going to do one large inverter or are you going to do micro inverters? There's all kinds of complexities that very quickly come into play. And if it's not done right, well, you know, there's no difference between you messing around with your electrical panel in the basement and shocking yourself or, you know, the solar stuff going wrong on your roof and catching a fire. And then sure enough, now that the Walmart story hit the papers, people are starting to dig around and say, what's going on? And there was a Bloomberg story that had a couple of examples
yeah,
of
saw that.
People, residential
right?
fires. Yeah,
yeah,
real people, folks like
whose
you.
Homes caught fire. Yeah, I was reading about that.
A couple of folks on Tesla Q digging around, finding more and more lawsuits at the state level that might be a little bit more difficult to find. Now, we're looking and, you know, you want to be careful to not be susceptible to confirmation bias and all of those things.
Sure.
But you read that Walmart lawsuit. And as I said earlier, if there was one client that a company like SolarCity would care a lot about, it would be the world's largest retailer. And the world's largest retailer knows how to deal with suppliers. And you should view SolarCity as nothing more than a supplier of green power to Walmart. And Walmart believes and has written in the legal brief that SolarCity has been grossly negligent in the installation, monitoring, and maintenance of these solar cells. And so that's, to me, a very interesting thing, because then very quickly becomes, what about solar roofs?
Yeah, and the thing that sticks out at me, sorry to interrupt your train of thought,
yeah,
but the thing that sticks out at me the most out of what you just said is, you know, two things. One is, arguably, you can make the argument that they're going to be paying more attention to the Walmart installs than anybody else, right? So if in terms of motivation to maintain and do things the right way, you have to kind of assume that because they're such a big name, that Walmart was, you know, kind of the pinnacle of how they would do the install and how they would maintain and service. And then the other alarming thing to me is, whether it's commercial or whether it's at a home, is this obligation to service these things for, you know, how the length of the contract, which very similar to buying a warranty on a Tesla. I mean, you want a company that you know is going to have staying power, that you know has the resources to do that and to do it correctly. You know, Teslas are very specialized vehicles for the most part. They're not traditional internal combustion engine vehicles. So there's some, you need to have somebody with some know-how, and it sounds like these solar arrays are extremely complex instruments as well that you need a specialist to do. So that would kind of alarm me, or at least, you know, make me a little bit cautious, those things.
Absolutely. And, you know, when you think about the incentives here, their incentive is to get you to sign so they get the tax credit.
Right.
Interestingly, a little aside, it turns out the tax credit is 30% of the total cost of install. And so there's a bit of motivation potentially to maybe run up the cost of install at the beginning. But then once they've got, you know, you committed to a future stream of payments and the tax credit funneled to variable interest entities that are then ultimately become sort of the owners of the asset, there's very little motivation to spend. Well, I mean, the motivation is to spend as little as possible on maintaining and following up on these sites, except if they don't work and you know that they have a minimum power obligation. Well, I guess you could say that's one of your hedges as a consumer. But the real incentive is to get it done correctly the first time. That is the most value creating, the most accretive set of activities for the company, except when you're really motivated to continuously show higher and higher megawatts installed, then I suspect that the growth pains that come from 20% growth year over year, quarter after quarter, as you try to scale this up, the more you grow, the harder it becomes to grow, as you know. And so I do wonder whether in their zeal to show growth to promote the stock, they may have potentially skipped a few corners that resulted in situations like the one at Walmart. Now, Tesla has a chance to counter, and they have said publicly that this is a very, very small number of incidents. And, you know, in the classic Tesla PR spin, it's a little hard to take that PR at face value when you've seen them gaslight everybody on 55 other issues. But in this narrow particular issue, everybody has their day in court. I just wonder about whether the integrated potential liability across all of the installs of SolarCity is properly reflected in the company financials. We'll see, but it's an interesting thing. And you know, once Tesla acquired SolarCity, they shifted away from this model because, in fact, the numbers don't work. I believe that it actually doesn't fundamentally create economic value. And SolarCity itself, despite pretty stupendous growth to their credit, by late 2015 had entered into a liquidity crisis where it was very apparent that its cash balances were going to run down to the level where it would trip a bunch of covenants and other debt structures that would basically lead to bankruptcy of the equity and the need to restructure. And so despite all of this growth, and potentially at least, you know, cutting corners, they still weren't able to create economic value, I believe, to the point where you could have a sustainable business. And once Tesla acquired them, they sort of, as Jonas famously characterized it, Adam Jonas from Morgan Stanley, an analyst who covers Tesla and by extension SolarCity, in a private call with investors, characterized the acquisition and subsequent decline of the SolarCity business as a controlled detonation, because it really wasn't creating economic value, which is a whole thing we could get into, of course, a bit later, which is the acquisition of SolarCity and why that spurred so many people to look at Tesla in a different way, including me. This was my introduction to Tesla.
Sure. Yeah. And there's still ongoing litigation relating to that, right?
Mm-hmm. Which is a whole separate topic that we'll get into. So let's pivot to how I became interested in this story, because solar is one thing and panels, you know, the traditional mounted panels, you might have, say, 15 panels in an array on your home. Those are difficult enough to manage because of all the issues we talked about, which is converting the DC into AC, and do you do them in series, and what do the connectors look like, and do you do microinverters? Well, all of that becomes infinitely more complex if you try to do solar roof shingle, where you replace all of your shingles on your home with a new product that acts simultaneously as a shingle that keeps the water out of your home, but also produces power.
Right. So for people that are not familiar with any of this, and maybe you're listening to this as their first episode, what you're talking about is, you know, everything that we've just described are using traditional solar panels, the big giant fuckers that you see on people's rooftops, right? And now what he's getting into is Elon Musk promising to take that technology and put it into something that looks like a traditional roof shingle. My guess is they would have to minimize the technology to some degree, but you can talk about this, you know, which he famously pitched, I think as either right before or right after they acquired SolarCity, what the future of SolarCity's technology would be like. He's standing on stage, he's holding these little things that look just like roof shingles. We discussed this on the last podcast. And the point you're trying to get to is, how do you take all of this complex technology that we're talking about now from traditional solar panels and then zip them down into something that also acts as a roof shingle?
Yeah. And I'll give maybe 2 minutes of context for those that haven't listened to the last episode, because it's important. He pitched the solar roof shingle as a pivotal growth synergy to justify the merger of Tesla and SolarCity. That pitch around solar roof technology occurred after the deal was announced, but before the shareholders voted for it.
Right.
And it was pitched as a way to convince, at that point, skeptical investors that there was a real legitimate reason for Tesla to acquire SolarCity.
Right.
And as we'll talk about in the lawsuit, I think that's quite the stretch, but that's a separate lawsuit that we'll talk about after we talk about the technical challenges around solar roofs and how I came to the story. So the concept of a solar roof shingle is very seductive. Everybody has a roof. They tend to replace them every 15 or 20 years. They're just sitting there. Why not add a dimension of functionality to your roof that allows you to passively produce most of the power you need to run your home? Many, many companies have tried to do this, and it turns out it's a very, very difficult problem. As Elon himself admitted in the most recent documents, they quoted his deposition, it's an incredibly challenging problem. Now, none of that was conveyed the night of the solar shingle reveal, which was meant to convince Tesla shareholders to vote for the SolarCity deal. But here's why it's complex, and it gets back to the thing we started with. These solar shingles create direct current, and you need to figure out a way to harvest all of that energy safely into a form that's usable, i.e. AC.
Right.
Now, we didn't talk a lot with the panel, but if you string them together in series, which is the way most of these panels are done, if one of those panels goes bad, you basically reduce the whole efficiency of the system. It's the Christmas light phenomenon that I referred to earlier.
Right.
Imagine taking that risk from 15 large arrays to 1,000 shingles on your roof. And so in the last episode where we talked about why is this a hard problem, this is really, we didn't get into it, but the opportunity to come back and give you a deeper technical background at a level that, you know, most lay people listening could understand is one that I was looking forward to, because it really is that hard. So if you're going to connect them all together, any one bad shingle becomes a problem. And there's all kinds of different orientations on your roof, so you really can't do it that way. Do you string them together and have multiple inverters? Do you have microinverters at every shingle? Then all of a sudden, you got an awful lot of hardware hanging off the back end of your shingle. That's expensive, by the way. So if it's expensive to do with 15 arrays, how much is it going to cost to do with 1,000? And then don't forget, the purpose of your shingle is to keep water out. And so if you start loading all this stuff up with wires and connectors and, you know, micro inverters and all of the things that come with that, let alone the expense, it very quickly could get out of hand and be unwieldy. And all it takes is, you know, I've owned a lot of homes as an executive. I was moved around a lot. It doesn't take too big of a hole in your roof to cause a big problem inside.
Right.
Water has a funny way of finding its way into your home when your roof isn't working as it should.
I keep thinking of Christmas Vacation. He's like, we checked them all, Russ, didn't we? We checked all of them, Russ. He's like, yeah, Dad, checked them all. A little knot here. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's exactly it, right? So you take that and you multiply the complexity by 100, and that's what you have here. And so with my sort of knowledge and background of the challenge of that problem, and I would say, look, I understand it's a seductive potential answer to alternative energy.
Yeah, sure is.
And that's the whole point of what I believe draws Elon to these types of things. Take a seductive, easy to communicate potential solution to a problem, overlook all of the complexities, overpromise by an order of magnitude of what you can do, and then laugh at everybody in the field for not yet having accomplished it, which is sort of his standard MO now as we investigate all the other stuff. So I was a complete neophyte to Elon. I had a relatively positive opinion of him. I knew a lot about solar shingle technology. I knew a lot about solar technology. I'm a big believer in trying to find ways to power consumers that minimize their carbon footprint. I famously bought a Chevy Volt as part of Tesla Charts just to show the Tesla bulls that I'm not, you know, the Koch brothers funded big oil, evil polluter who is ruining the planet for my children, who I love and would love to leave a clean planet too. So I watched this reveal, and out comes Elon and claims that all of the houses around him are solar. They weren't. They were fake. I can say now definitively they were fake, because in the lawsuit that just got released, you know, the documents just got released in this shareholder lawsuit last week, they basically admitted under penalty of perjury that, in fact, those weren't real solar shingles. They were fake. I knew they were fake in the moment. They had to be fake, because he holds up this sleek, very thin, gorgeous tile with no connectors, no wires, no nothing on the back.
Right.
And if you look at the roof, if you go back now and rewatch that solar reveal, which is still available on YouTube, after listening to this podcast, you will be blown away, and you will be as blown away as I was that night watching that reveal.
Right.
Because I'm looking at a guy who's being held up as a genius and an innovator, and I'm thinking he's making all of this up.
Right. You got a couple pieces of ceramic up there, and and that's it.
And so he's holding up this shingle, and my jaw is on the floor, because I'm like, what is this? Like,
right.
You can't just walk out and say, the reason why nobody has these is because everyone else who's tried to make them made ugly versions of them. I've made a beautiful version of it. Look at how smart I am. Let's close this deal. Now, obviously, I'm summarizing and I'm putting words in his mouth, maybe a little unfairly, but that's the message that was conveyed to the audience, which is, I'm a brilliant design person. I'm a brilliant innovator. I'm a brilliant technologist. I've solved this problem. Look at these gorgeous shingles. These two companies need to be together. Well, anybody can make a shingle that works like a shingle and has a non-functioning solar cell in it. It's actually not that hard.
We don't even know if they worked as shingles either.
Well, I mean, they look pretty nice, to be fair. When they fake stuff, they do it good.
Right.
It was a gorgeous looking roof.
I'm just saying.
Yeah, it doesn't rain much in California, so we don't really know. But as you know, or maybe you don't know, that reveal was done on the set of Desperate Housewives.
Ah, where I do all of my reveals.
Yeah, I could take that in a direction that I won't.
Yeah.
But they were very clean looking. He had four different versions of it, I believe. They had all these sleek videos of, you know, dropping a bowling ball on it and it didn't break. And look at these magical tiles and blah, blah,
and
blah.
And Elon
blah,
wore
blah.
A sweater. It was very fancy.
It was a very, you know, I'm sure the food was great. And I remember distinctly at the beginning, and I hadn't heard him talk before that. And let's be generous and say he's not the most gifted public speaker.
He's a bit of a mumbler.
And so he's talking about global warming and how basically what he's about to show you is going to solve global warming. And somebody in the audience screams, I'll never forget it, "Save us, Elon." And if you go back and listen to the video, it happens pretty early. And I'm a skeptic. You're a skeptic. I think we're united by our skepticism. Most people who own gold are skeptical. I'm a big believer in owning gold, like you, and real assets, stuff that'll survive whatever's going to happen in the current monetary regime. When I heard "Save us, Elon," my skepticism hat got pulled out of the shelf and onto my head, and I started listening with a bit more attention, because there is no one single human that's going to quote unquote save humanity. And one of the big red flags for me that triggers my skeptical nature is this hero worship that somehow, you know, one person is going to be miraculously the savior. Generally speaking, saviors don't save anybody but themselves.
And Montana skeptic always says, you know, it's a religion, it's a faith-based thesis.
100%. So before we jump into the lawsuit, anything about, I mean, I thought hopefully I was clear at a level that is accurate, but still, you know, at a level where most listeners who maybe aren't trained in the technology could at least follow the story along.
This is good because you're framing this for me too, and I'm learning as I go along here as well. I can just imagine, you know, the delta between what you probably thought watching this thing for the first time versus what the average person who is not an expert in solar panel technology probably thought was a very, very wide delta. And so what you're trying to do is kind of narrow that a little bit and kind of give people. I think it's interesting your suggestion to go back and watch the video now, given what you've talked about.
Yeah, because it really will, I think, open your eyes. If you just, and maybe even before watching the video, spend an hour on Wikipedia, or, you know, you can learn anything, watch some YouTube videos about how solar technology works and all of this other stuff. And very quickly you'll see, like, he comes out and he addresses none of that, and the shingles have no wires on them, and, you know, they're just going to magically work. And that's why Tesla should buy
his poor team that he probably turned around to after that and was like, well, you heard what I said, fucking put it together. Like, oh my God, those poor people.
Well, there are 2 points that flow from this. One is that I think is a big explanation for the massive, unprecedented executive turnover that we see. You know, and his enablers like Ross and, you know, Ark and all these other folks will say he's just a tough guy and very demanding and not everybody can cut it. Well, yeah, not everybody's willing to make stuff up. And not everybody's willing to just promise the world when they know in their mind and in their heart that it's actually impossible to do.
Right.
There's a fine line between saying something that you know is literally untrue, but you plan to use the protection of forward-looking statements. You know, I do think once this whole Silicon Valley bubble, which I believe is the catalyst for the next financial crisis, there's always the next financial crisis, when the Silicon Valley bubble bursts of people basically just lying their way to higher multiples and and all that, when all that bursts, I think that one of the things the SEC as archaeologists will have to do is have a hard look at the forward-looking statement protections provided executives, because I believe these are being abused as licenses to outright lie.
Right.
And they know you're either smart or you're a liar. You're either dumb or you're a liar. Which is it, right? Like, you can't be a genius and say something that everyone else that knows even a superficial amount about the technology knows is wrong. And be telling the truth in your heart. And I do think, you know, broadly speaking, we see more and more people using the protections of forward-looking statements and all the legalese that's on slide 2 of every earnings call as a license to outright fabricate things.
Right.
And I don't just, to me, fundamentally, I find it offensive.
Well, if you think that the Silicon Valley is kind of, if that's going to be the catalyst to the next financial crisis, this, you know, market chewing up the WeWork IPO and then barfing it back out back to them and saying, you know,
I hope.
Go fly a kite. It might be some type of inflection point, huh?
Well, I would hope. You know, we see the Uber IPO, all of these cash draining unicorns. And, you know, unicorn has become a bit of a derogatory term. And there was a time where every startup aspired to be a unicorn because the literal definition of a unicorn was you closed a funding round at a valuation greater than $1 billion. Who wouldn't want that as a founder? But the problem is, if the only way to get it is to lie your face off, then do you really want it? So the whole point of Silicon Valley, I believe, in this generation, the leaders of Silicon Valley of this generation ought to be ashamed of themselves, because they've done nothing but annihilate investor capital in the name of growth,
right? And in the name of in the name of innovation that had already occurred. You know, you have all these great
derivative
Silicon Valley success stories that happened throughout the 80s and the 90s, and then of course some of them got puked back in the late 2000s, early 2000s. But you know, with Amazon finally turning a profit, and names like Salesforce, and a lot of these successful names, even Microsoft, you know, going into cloud and stuff like that, it's very easy to point back and go, "Oh, growth's more important." And then what happens is you wind up with just a complete disaster, a complete cesspool of unprofitable companies with insanely egregious valuations. And like you're saying, nobody knows when the tide's going to go out, right? And when it does, it's going to take some companies with it.
Yeah. I mean, it's a bit of a diversion, but I do think that the thing I watch, I've tweeted about this the most, is this whole SoftBank issue. Most people don't realize that SoftBank is basically the most, one of the most indebted entities on the planet. They highly leveraged. They
extremely exposed to all this crap.
Very exposed. The reason that they've been successful, one of the reasons they've been successful, aside from, you know, Masa's ability to pick winners, is they create an enormous amount of fees for Wall Street. And so that gets you a lot of favors as you bring these things to market. But I think the failure, I'd say it's probably safe to say that the Uber IPO was a failure. It's trading at something like 25 or 30% below the IPO price. Lyft is trading at 50% of the IPO price. You know, round numbers, don't hold me to the exact. But if WeWork gets bounced back and they pull the IPO, or the IPO this thing at one third of the last private valuation, that's the kind of thing that could, and maybe it's just me being hopeful, begin the process of people looking at companies in the more traditional way: cash flow, profitability, excellence in management, truth in management, setting reasonable goals, being a good leader, respecting your people, creating true triple bottom line economic value. All of these things that sort of get ridiculed now, the value investor, you know, David Einhorn type companies, hopefully will come back in vogue. Because I don't think it's good for the environment to incinerate investor capital in a greater fool's theory where you just hope that when the music stops, you're sitting down.
Right.
And that's what I believe is going on right now. And the private mark to market, you know, I continuously invest smaller amounts of money at higher valuations so I can mark my whole book up, is like the oldest game in the book, and it's run amok. Right. And I think WeWork is just one example, one very egregious example of it. There's, I don't think, well, personally, what is WeWork worth? It's a duration mismatched REIT. You know, it borrows long and it sells short.
And it's the type of setup where you can, where certain disaster can be realized in extremely short order. Because like when you say, when you have guys painting their books with these insane valuations, which basically what you're talking about, for those that aren't familiar, is, you know, when you buy into a round of financing in a company that values the company at a certain dollar amount, and you may not be hoping the company makes it for the long term or 5 years or 5 months. All you're hoping is that that next round of financing is going to come in at a 10 or 20% higher valuation, and the people that are buying in at that valuation are thinking the same thing. So it becomes this, you know, to some degree Ponzi-ish sort of past the hot potato. Right. And the problem with that is, after you kind of take the stairs up, as they say, you can wind up taking the elevator down, where, you know, you wake up the next morning, and if the market decides to barf all this shit back up, you're going to be marking all of this stuff in your book significantly lower all at once. And that is where you get major problems and huge stresses on the economic system.
And if you just look at WeWork and SoftBank, I'm not an expert. I read this. I believe that they use leverage in their investment in WeWork, and so let's imagine it's 50% levered, and they go to market and they mark it down you know, all of a sudden you can wipe out your equity on one mark.
Right.
And so if they're talking about 15 to 20 billion when the last private round was 47, I was talking to a few folks that work on Wall Street last night and doing a little research for the podcast today. And, you know, I've never worked on Wall Street. I've made this very clear. I'm a one company person. I've tweeted about basically almost exclusively Tesla. I do occasionally wander into other names that pique my interest. You know, this is not how IPOs work. Like, Elon himself in this lawsuit, which we'll talk about next, said, you know, the funny thing about banks is when you're dangerously low on money, they don't want to lend to you. It's ironic. I was like, yeah, you know, no shit. That's how it works. You want to go to market at 47 billion. You're doing that on the promise that this is going to jump to, like, you know, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 billion and become the next Facebook or the next Apple. If you're coming to market at 15 or 20 billion and you got all of these private investors on top of you underwater, that kind of puts a ceiling on the potential growth of this company going forward. And generally speaking, this is not how IPOs go. You know, one of my good friends who does a lot of investing in startups and VCs and things like that has a great expression, which is every deal is undersubscribed except for the ones that are oversubscribed. And you want to be on the hot one that's oversubscribed.
Right.
And this is the sort of quintessential undersubscribed deal that looks like, now we're talking today, September 10th, you know, 4:45 in the afternoon. Who knows how the saga is going to play out. I'll take the under on whether this thing actually comes to market.
Well, there was a headline that passed the wire just a couple of minutes before we started the podcast saying that somebody had valued the company at $18.3 billion. Prior to all the IPO stuff getting. So somebody out there had already assigned them a valuation that was, I think they were hoping to IPO at, 20 to 40 billion?
No, 47.
At 47 billion, right. So somebody had already ascribed a valuation of $18 billion to the company, which is a $30 billion difference. And in the zero-sum game that's finance, that value has to come from somewhere, and it has to disappear from somewhere.
And catastrophic for SoftBank if they're leveraged in their investment.
Sure.
So I don't know all the particulars, and finance is, you know, complex, and, you know, my price, your terms is one of my favorite expression. Who knows how the deals were structured with SoftBank and what protections they have and all these other things, but if you dig a little deeper into the sort of the vision fund of SoftBank, they put $300 million in a dog walking company. I can't imagine. I don't know what their book looks like. So I tweeted last night, you know, what other private marks have they pledged for loans?
Right.
What does that garbage look like? Because this is all just, I believe, not all, but this generation of Silicon Valley unicorn companies is characterized by a bunch of promises and a bunch of cash burn.
Right.
You give me $1 billion, I could burn a lot of cash.
Right.
It's not that hard, actually. It doesn't take a genius to burn a lot of cash. I could sell dollar bills for 80 cents and show you growth. So that's what I think is going on here. Taking
a lot of mundane, everyday kind of products, services, and tasks, like you're talking about dog walking, you know, putting that into an app and then saying you've created something that's revolutionary and innovative, when all you're doing is, you know, taking a product or a service that's already out there and just, you know, giving it to people on an iPhone app instead of having them call the company or schedule it online.
Well, you famously did a whole episode on Jim Cramer saying Domino's Pizza was a tech company.
I did do that.
One of my favorite episodes, actually, because I did a little research on Domino's as well. But it's that's just the nature of the time that we live in. And so because the street seems to be rewarding that type of, I would say, fraud, and regulators are historically impotent, there's never been a better time to be a fraud, both from the rewards of being a fraud and the probability you'll get away with it. And that's sad. And, you know, as a patriotic American that believes in capitalism, it angers me.
Yeah,
it's just not the way things
should be. It's offensive.
Offensive.
It's personal. Like I take that personally When I see Jim Cramer get on television and say Domino's Pizza is a technology company and not a pizza company, which, look, on its face, right, we know is such a horseshit statement, because all you got to do is walk into a fucking Domino's right now and there's a guy in there making a pizza. He's not in there wiring a fucking microprocessor to a motherboard, right? So we know Domino's is a pizza company, but to me, it's so odious. And it's just so offensive that he would do that. And the worst part is that there's people out there that don't know better. You know, they know Kramer's the guy on TV, and they know he's made some money somehow. And they listen and they say, wow, you know, maybe a 35 multiple for this company that makes shitty pizza really does make sense. And that's I take offense on behalf of people that don't have the financial sophistication to understand what he's doing for them. And that's part of the reason that I did that episode and part of the reason that I do the podcast in general. I mean, that's just bullshit.
And let me tell you who does understand it. All of the underwriters at Goldman.
Fuck right, yeah.
Investment banks that are exactly. Shoving all this garbage onto retails. They know what garbage is because they're smart enough to get a job at freaking Goldman.
Exactly. Remember when they were reading in the congressional hearing after 2008, they were like, man, that was one shitty deal.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, you got to be a smart person to get a job at Goldman. Yeah. You're probably a Ivy League undergrad and, you know, did a little work and then got your MBA at Harvard or Wharton or Booth and then jumped your way into investment banking. I mean, this is the elite of the elite, and this is not, you know, this is not Fred Lambert getting a job at Goldman Sachs, just to pick on one of
those
my favorite,
guys used to come out of Penn and into my bar all the time in downtown Philly, and none of them can fucking hold their liquor, all right? So we got beef with them with what they're doing on Wall Street. My beef goes all the way back to them not being able to handle a couple of Miller Lights without falling over.
I'm on my second 16-ounce Coors Light of this podcast.
Founders. all right, well, that's good. We like that.
So let's pivot into the shareholder lawsuit that dropped over the weekend, because I think that's very interesting and ties us back to SolarCity and Solar Roofs.
Let's
and
do it.
The Walmart lawsuit and all that stuff. So for those that aren't aware, this is a very fascinating and I think dangerous lawsuit for Tesla making its way through the Delaware Chancery Court. For those that don't know, the Delaware Chancery Court is really the place where business is done. You know, almost all corporations, not all, but a fair number of the corporations are incorporated in Delaware for a reason. They have both favorable contract laws for corporations, but also they have a pretty fair mechanism to settle contract disputes. And so a lot of corporations are incorporated there. All of the businesses that I've started have been Delaware corporations, with one exception. So with the SolarCity deal, we talked about it in the last episode, but I'll give maybe a 1-minute summary of the is state at the time that deal was proposed. Elon was the chair of the board of SolarCity and the largest shareholder, more than 20%. His cousins were the senior leaders, CEO and CTO, chief technology officer. There was a lot of overlap between the Tesla and SolarCity boards, not the least of which was his brother Kimball Musk, sat on both boards.
Love that guy.
There was a lot of overlap between SolarCity and SpaceX, another one of Elon's companies. SpaceX owned a big chunk, more than $100 million, I think it was $200 million worth of SolarCity bonds. By the time the deal vote was happening and Elon was doing that shingle reveal, he had personally bought another $65 million in bonds, and his cousin had bought another $35 million. He had pledged a fair amount of his SolarCity stock to get loans in part to buy those bonds. He was very, very conflicted from a fiduciary perspective. He's CEO and co-founder of Tesla, if you will, and chair of the Tesla board. He's chair of the SolarCity board, big stock owner in both. He's also obviously founder of SpaceX and the dominant shareholder in SpaceX. And these are all commingled. And in late 2015, SolarCity is facing a liquidity crisis. They're basically insolvent. The record shows that. The lawsuit that was released this weekend confirms that. Lots of internal discussions about tripping various covenants. And Elon basically works with the Tesla board to, if the plaintiff's accusation is correct, bail out SolarCity. They acquire them in an equity deal. They dilute Tesla shareholders. SolarCity kind of goes away as a problem. And from Elon's perspective, the alternative to bailing out SolarCity using Tesla's equity is SolarCity goes bankrupt. SpaceX loses a lot of money. He loses a lot of money. More importantly, he loses a lot of reputation. And one of the things that Elon desperately needs for the entire empire is a reputation of being able to raise money. If you have a bankruptcy under you, it becomes harder to raise money, although the president might say otherwise. For Elon, I think it was an existential threat. And so Tesla bought SolarCity in part because of Elon's promises around the solar roof tile and that solar shingle reveal. And there we have it. All the problems go away, except they don't. Major shareholders of Tesla at the time, namely a pension fund, is the lead sort of plaintiff in this case, are suing the Tesla board and Elon for breach of fiduciary, essentially, for Tesla shareholders in Delaware. And it's kind of an interesting case. I'm not a lawyer, but I've talked to a few lawyers about this case. This is what's known as a derivative lawsuit. So technically, Tesla is suing these board directors via these shareholders over Tesla's objection. These shareholders have won the right to sue these board directors in Delaware in what's known as a derivative lawsuit. I didn't know that was a thing, but apparently that's what's happening.
Yeah, here. Derivative lawsuit, I think, is when shareholders sue the board on behalf of the company.
Mm-hmm. And in this case, over the company, quote unquote, because you think of Elon as the company, over the company's objections. Because clearly the board directors don't want to be sued by shareholders. So that lawsuit, which I think is a very, very potentially lethal threat to the entire enterprise here, is making its way through the Delaware courts. And over the weekend, Plainsight, your friend Aaron Greenspan, who is one determined, dogged MF.
Yeah, he is a tenacious motherfucker, isn't he? Oh my God. Every time that dude posts something on Twitter, I'm like, I'm glad I didn't piss this guy off.
I just say for the record, I'm glad he's in Tesla Q. But, you know, to his credit, he is tenacious. And he was quick to publish the latest series of documents that dropped in the SolarCity lawsuit in Delaware. And the plaintiff's brief, if you haven't read it, document 302 in this docket. If you go to Plainsight, you know, at Plainsight on Twitter and just search, you know, SolarCity from Plainsight, and you'll find the latest link. The PDF is really an amazing read. And I would say it validates a lot of my history in Tesla Q, which is interesting to me, probably not to your listeners. But I started Tesla Charts because of SolarCity. Probably my most famous thread on Twitter was a 25-part expose on the SolarCity deal, extracted from previous legal documents. Famously, Elon was, I think, triggered by that thread and came at me on Twitter, and sort of the Tesla Charts thing took off wildly beyond my what I could have possibly imagined when I started. But this plaintiff's brief in the Chancery Court in the state of Delaware is really an amazing thing. And I would encourage everybody to read it. It's a very quick read. You know, legal documents are actually pretty readable. A lot of it is unfortunately redacted, which itself is an interesting thing. But it's very clear that Elon and the key players, including the board members, have been deposed in this lawsuit. And what I wouldn't give to get a copy of Elon's deposition.
Oh boy!
Yeah, because I can't imagine how that went. I mean, I can't.
That could be a Tesla Q viewing party.
Oh yeah, I mean, forget the viewing party. A reading party. We'll have a Tesla Q reading party. I take just the ability to read it.
I want the full audio because I want the I want the pauses and the awkwardness and the mumbles.
And the anger and the
resentment, right? Exactly.
I imagine there might just be a scotch of narcissistic rage,
like
that occurred.
Jack Nicholson and Good Men, where he's like,
"You need me on that wall."
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Who else is going to save the
end
planet?
Of the night? You want me on that wall?
Who else is going to save the planet?
Right, right. Oh, that's funny.
And so, but there's a lot of amazing things in that document, which basically, the deal closed in November of 2016, a year after Elon first found out that SolarCity wasn't sold. Internal documents show they're stacking their vendors, who they're going to pay. You know, we're going to trip this covenant. We need to do something. The banks are on record telling, you know, the CEO of SolarCity at the time that they probably couldn't even get an ugly convert done. And so then something has to happen. Now, the reason this is so outrageous to people that come from the corporate world is if you're going to use the assets of one company to bail out another and you're conflicted, there's a way to go about it. And for everyone else on the planet, if you don't go about it that way, you get in big trouble. So, for example, when Michael Dell decided that he wanted to take Dell private, that triggered a whole series of things that the board did properly to make sure that they were getting the right deal, the fair deal, that, you know, but there's special committees, and you know yourself, securities lawyers look over everything.
Independent valuations need to get done.
Yeah. And this was basically, if you believe the plaintiff's brief, I do, but that doesn't mean it's right. It is basically worse than you could have imagined. You know, you have Evercore on the Tesla side, and you have Lazard on the SolarCity side. These are bankers that advise boards and whatnot on various aspects of the deal for healthy fees. Basically pointing out that there's a liquidity crisis here. In the valuation model that Evercore used to present to the board of Tesla to say this was a fair deal, they had a massive sophomoric error in their discounted cash flow valuation model of SolarCity. That was never revealed to shareholders before they voted. Not to get too deep into the weeds, but basically the credit that I described earlier that is at the heart of the entire business model is set to expire in 2022. And in their terminal value calculation of the value of SolarCity, they just assumed that the cashes would flow at a 3-5% perpetuity forever, ignoring the fact that a key tax credit at the heart of the entire business model is set to expire in 2022.
Right.
Which would have destroyed the value of SolarCity from the eyes of Tesla. And so they have this whole song and dance. Elon is clearly deeply involved in the negotiations, even though they sort of profess that he recused himself from the vote.
Right.
Well, you know, recusing yourself from the vote doesn't really matter. That's actually not, in my opinion, sufficient executive behavior when you're conflicted. But it turns out almost everybody on the board is totally conflicted. And these are just sort of undisputed statements of fact. And I'm just going to flip through the lawsuit to go through it. But, you know, you start with Elon, who's clearly very conflicted. He's on both sides of the transaction. He owns 20% of SolarCity. The next person is on the – now let's just look at the Tesla board. Is the Tesla board free from free from conflicts?
Right.
As it pertains to the acquisition of SolarCity. So you start with Elon. It's very clear that Elon is conflicted. Everybody agrees with that. You know, he owns as much a percentage of SolarCity as he does Tesla. So that's fine. Everybody knows that he's conflicted. A board member on Tesla is Kimball. Well, Kimball is Elon's brother, which automatically, if Elon's conflicted, then clearly Kimball is, as his brother, and that's fair. I mean, there's a reason that families matter, and, you know,
Right. Spouses
don't testify against each other because, you know, there's a conflict there. But he was also, in addition to that sort of profound conflict, he was a major shareholder in SolarCity. So at the time of the acquisition, and the acquisition target price was something around $26, Kimball owned 147,101 shares of SolarCity. Okay. He's clearly on both sides of the transaction. Brad Buss is on the board of Tesla. Brad Buss was, guess what, the former CFO of SolarCity. And at the time of the acquisition, he owned 37,000 plus shares. Aaron Priss served on the board of SolarCity and Tesla and was therefore obviously conflicted. So the only board member, you know, Steve Jurvetson was a big investor in SolarCity, sat on the board of Tesla. Antonio Gracias, he owned, personally owned 211,000 shares of SolarCity at the time of the deal. The only board member that doesn't seem to outright own SolarCity stock at the time that this deal was voted on by the board is the current chair, Robin Granholm. And so you could say that she wasn't conflicted.
Denholm.
And Tesla.
Robin Denholm.
Yeah, sorry. Robin Denholm. You're right. Yeah, I'm sorry. I mispronounced her name. And in Tesla's response and in their brief, they do point out that she spent hundreds of hours looking at this deal and blah, 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 blah. But it is a very inward-looking, incestuous transaction that made no sense, I believe, to Tesla shareholders. I think that this is a very interesting and potentially dangerous case to the board members personally. They've hired a very well-to-do, very expensive law firm to represent them. They've taken this very seriously. They've allowed it to get to the point of depositions. So we'll see. I would, like I said earlier, I would very much love to read.
And it doesn't seem like anything that they've unearthed so far is going to prevent it from proceeding. I mean, obviously, I'm not an attorney, and this isn't legal advice, and it's not investment advice. Mm-hmm. But when you think about kind of each of these two sides trying to stack up pieces and little wins and ammunition that they can use in making their argument that they either, you know, were or were not negligent, it doesn't really seem like anything's come down on the side of SolarCity thus far, based on my analysis.
So let's go to the Tesla, Elon, the board directors, what their argument is. Their argument basically comes down to the shareholders voted to approve the deal.
Right.
But that's fine, and it's important. And I believe if they had done this in a different way, they probably still could have gotten a deal done and not gotten themselves in trouble. The best chance for them to get this deal done properly, I think, would have just been to tell the truth. Look, you know, the bankruptcy of SolarCity would cause severe reputational damage to Tesla. Elon is critical to both companies. One of the reasons why SolarCity is struggling is because he has to spend a ton of time at Tesla. It makes a lot of sense for Tesla and SolarCity to come together. And so even though this is a highly conflicted deal and SolarCity might not be the very best independent solar company to buy if you're Tesla, we're going to do it anyway because in totality it makes the most sense for shareholders. Actually, I think that argument is both true. It's the motivation and it might pass muster. That's not what they did. They said this is a no-brainer. There's lots of synergies. This is a great company. None of the minutes reflect the necessity of preserving Elon's reputation or the desire to converge his time on one entity as opposed to two and straddling both and all this other stuff that comes with the inherent conflict of trying to run multiple companies. One of the things that I hope comes out of this is that, you know, you shouldn't be allowed to be CEO of multiple companies. Look at Jack with Square and Twitter. How can you say that he's equally giving his fiduciary to both shareholders? But alas, that's not what happened. What happened was the history that we've described. And now we have this, I think, very consequential lawsuit making its way through the Delaware courts. One of the frustrating things from Tesla Q's perspective is just how long it takes for all this stuff to manifest in reality. Like, I knew in the moment, 3 years ago now, almost, that those shingles were fake. And yet here we are. He's still the CEO. He's just this weekend talking about...
He's gotten away with stuff like this, too. I mean, when you look back at the $35,000 Model 3 presentation, you know, what happened was he presented that he was going to be offering a $35,000 Model 3. He collected, you know, a significant amount of deposits on that. And then he was afforded the time to deliver, which he, you know, painfully and finally excruciatingly did years down the road, right? So the model of kind of promising first and dealing with the consequences later, you know, if you're him, why wouldn't you do that, right? It's worked out so far.
There's never been a better time to ignore regulators. So again, but the thing is, this is everywhere you look in the Tesla group of activities. It only happens to be that my background in solar and all of that, and this particularly egregious self-dealing deal, I believe, is what led me to get into the story and then ultimately start Tesla Charts. And here we are. But it is an amazingly long time for law. And just look at autopilot and the NTSB and the NHTSA. What the NHTSA in particular, I think, is an utterly corrupted organization. It can't be that they turn a blind eye to just Tesla. You know, people sleeping while they drive their cars, their dogs driving their car. They have these weights on the wheels so that they could circumvent Tesla's, I think, utterly inefficient driver awareness system. We have cars crashing into 18-wheelers. You know, you have the FDA going crazy over vaping this week because of 3 deaths, they claim.
Right.
And that might be the case, and I don't know anything about it. But we've had at least as many autopilot deaths, and nobody seems to care.
Well, and what the fuck is it going to take? You know, if you haven't been following the story closely, like, this is what's cool, what I like about doing the podcast, right? If you didn't follow the SolarCity story very closely, and you saw that the two companies merge and this, that, and the other, and, you know, life goes on, you probably didn't know any of the stuff that you just talked about for the last hour and a half. You know, vice versa, if you haven't been following the Tesla story very closely, you may know, yeah, well, a couple of people may have, you know, gotten into accidents and injuries with autopilot, but, you know, these are the outliers, etc. When the fact is, if you read into the details, a lot of these accidents and how they happen, you know, cars on autopilot slamming into inanimate objects, you know, cars on autopilot missing temporary construction zones on the roads and things like that. They're very, very big deals, and they ensure to me personally, I mean, to me, that ensures that there will be more of these coming, at least unless the company can catch up, you know, with its hardware, with its software, that more of these instances are going to happen. So my question is, what is the big event that happens that finally, let's just say the NHTSA has been investigating it, and maybe they're a little hesitant to go after Elon Musk for PR purposes, which I think is a plausible scenario. I don't have any proof of it. What is it going to take? I mean, are we going to have to be watching some type of, you know, sporting event on live television where a Tesla just bursts through the fucking arena and takes out, you know, half of the Tennessee Titans on the 50-yard line? I mean, what type of high-profile disaster are we going to need for them to wake up? Because there's no doubt to me that these things are absolutely dangerous. And in addition to that, which I've said a million times, the way he conveyed this to the public, saying in one of his presentations, you know, oh, in a year you'll be able to sleep, you'll be able to read a book.
Yeah, yeah.
Was not the right way to do it. Go ahead.
I honestly think it's going to take them running out of money and failing for normal business reasons before any regulator will have the courage to act. It's sad. I think it's a very sad statement. Look at the SEC with 420. Just this weekend, this guy who committed, I think, the greatest act of securities fraud in the history of the publicly traded markets, I think you agree, was, you know, charged by the SEC with securities fraud. He settled, you know, put his tail between his legs and settled after the stock started to drop after he was first a little defiant. Then violated, called his shots, went on 60 Minutes, said he wasn't going to follow the agreement. Then the SEC could basically, you know, go F themselves. Did it. And then the SEC charged him with contempt for basically him not following the settlement. Then he settled again. And then now, just this weekend, he's on Twitter promising that solar rentals, back to solar, are guaranteed, you know, ironclad money printers.
Yeah.
Like, where's the FTC? Can you imagine the CEO of a $40 billion company saying a product is a perpetual money printing machine? Just click a button and take my money. It's just outrageous that the SEC, the FTC, the NHTSA, all of these regulators that, believe me, if you and I did 1/100th of what this guy has done,
right,
we'd be in jail.
Right.
There's no, if you went onto the floor of the New York Stock Exchange and yelled fire like he did on August 7th of 2018, you would be in jail. Martha Stewart went to jail for a hell of a lot less than what this guy's gotten away with. But here he is, you know, guaranteeing a money printer. Just click a button on an app and I'll give you my money printer.
He said on, so I mean, I always talk about this, but I'm going to mention it again for those that aren't, you know, you're not a trader, you're not heavily engrossed in the financial world. To go out and fake a buyout, to say that you have funding secured to for a buyout of a company at, you know, $60 or $70 billion valuation when you don't, is just, it is, like you said, it's the most egregious form of fraud that you could possibly take on. I mean, if I told you, if I said to you, Tesla Charts, I want you to go and guarantee that you're going to get nailed for fraud and make it good. Go out there and do something to piss off the SEC and just wave your dick at the capital markets, you know, just in the worst way possible. You couldn't have come up with fucking going out and faking an $80 billion buyout. You wouldn't even thought of it. That's how far off the spectrum it is. And this guy... Go ahead.
I don't have a criminal mind. Like, I couldn't do it. I couldn't come up with it. You're 100% right.
Well, then, like, this guy does it, right? And then, like you said, is defiant when the SEC kind of perfunctorily calls him out for fraud. And then eventually, after they jostle back and forth, makes a settlement, violates the settlement, you know, comes up with a second settlement because he can't be trusted to abide by the first settlement. And here's the tweet from September 7th. You know, and basically the terms of his settlement are, don't make any material, you know, statements regarding the any type of finances, guidance involving the company. Everything's got to be reviewed by a lawyer. September 7th, he tweets out, without the removal fee, Tesla Solar is unequivocally a guaranteed instant money printer, producing $300 to $1,000 per year, wait for it, in after-tax income, with an exclamation mark at the end of it. This motherfucker, man. Unbelievable. Yeah.
Let me just say this. Domino's is more of a technology company than that statement is true.
Unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. I mean, imagine you're Jay Clayton. So Jay Clayton is the head of the SEC. Elon basically just took a leak in his cereal, smiled at him, and said, eat it.
Right.
And you know what? From what I could tell,
he's eating it.
He said, thank you, Elon. May I have another?
Yeah. We now consecrate the bond of obedience.
It's just amazing to me. And, like, the thing that's just, and I don't want to be repetitive, but it is stupefying. You and I get a stock tip on an insider M&A deal, and I make $5,000. I make $5,000 buying an out-of-the-money call option that expires on Friday. They're going to throw me in jail.
Right.
And this guy is, like, on Twitter. And it's not like this is his first offense. I mean, as you said, I mean, in the subset of people that have been charged with contempt of court for violating a settlement with the SEC, how many of them are still CEOs?
Right. Oh. See, I mean, I always say, too, what would have happened to any other CEO anywhere? You know, what would have happened if Satya Nadella from Microsoft came out and called Vern Unsworth a pedophile? You know, seriously, what would have happened?
Let's go down that rabbit hole. So that lawsuit is progressing. And I don't know if I'm sure you saw, because you're active on Twitter, and the attorney for Vern Unsworth, the cave dive rescuer slash hero whose only sin, it appears, was that he took offense at Elon trying to bring his cave submarine over to steal the limelight.
You
as
can
part
say
of the rescue.
Cave dildo, it's okay.
Yeah, you know, I'm just Montana skeptic has taught me that, you know, I should try my best in such public discourses to not swear. And
just say CD. We'll know.
Yeah, I've already said the word shit earlier on this podcast, so I'm going to get scolded by Montana, who, by the way, is a lovely person.
He really is.
One of my favorite people. So this poor cave diver, who, you know, was a little crude. He said Elon could take his submarine and shove it up as you know what. That triggered Elon in a fit of narcissistic rage that apparently lasted several weeks because not only did he go on Twitter and randomly call him a pedophile, he then followed up in an exchange with a BuzzFeed reporter basically saying he was a child rapist and married a 12-year-old. And apparently,
basically, that's verbatim what he said.
Yeah.
he didn't dance around the point. Like, he said he's a child rapist.
Like, yeah, he's like, I'm sitting next to my wife and she's the same age as me. I don't remember when she was 12 because I didn't know her and I certainly didn't marry her when she was 12.
Right.
But anyway, that lawsuit is progressing, and apparently around the same time that Elon was deposed in Silver City, he was also deposed in this lawsuit, and the attorney for Vern Unsworth put out a tweet, which I think was a brilliant maneuver to get to extract a much higher settlement from Elon. I'm sitting on this deposition, and it's incredible, and the emperor has no clothes, and when this comes out, everybody's going to see who the real Elon is. All that does is make sure that the price is going up, that deposition doesn't ever see the light of day. And in fact, if I had to pay to watch one of the depositions, Solar City or this one, I'd probably go with this one.
I would too. I was going to say that same exact thing before you said it. This would be the deposition I would like to see.
Yeah. I can only imagine how that went. You know, because, you know, he's been triggered on investor calls and stuff before. And I get the sense that he has created a culture in Tesla where not many people have the courage to oppose him.
I also get that sense.
Just a hunch.
Yeah.
Based on certain leadership characteristics I'm able to observe from a distance.
Well, and the entire C-suite turning over every, you know, 6 hours.
I mean, it's just crazy. And so here we are. You know, sometimes I wake up like, hey, I'm looking at the stock. It's at 235 today. I can't believe that 420 was over a year ago, and here we are still with this mess. He's promised 1 million robo-taxis next year. Bullshit. Solar City, you know, money printers. Bullshit. It just goes on and on and on. And this is a really good point. I wanted to make a plug for an excellent book that I read over the weekend from a reporter who is deeply involved in this story. Ed Niedermeyer's book, Ludicrous. Was it a really amazing read for me? I read it in one sitting, basically. And Ed's a car guy. I don't know if you know Ed. He's a reporter at The Drive.
Yeah, great work.
Great work. You know, the Tesla bulls hate him because he has had the audacity to challenge Elon and do great. You know, same thing with Lynette and Charlie and all the other reporters on the case. But his book is really interesting to me in particular because, as I said, I came to the story in 2016 late because of Solar City, and I'm certainly aware of all of the stuff that happened before 2016, but I didn't live it like I've lived the Tesla story since then. And Ed's a car guy, so he does look at the story from an automotive reporter's perspective. And if I had one criticism of the book, is it sort of downplays the Solar City transaction. Ed is a car guy, probably didn't see that as important as I think it is, but
well, that's why nonetheless
you're here. Yeah, well, you know, he filled in a big gap for me in reading this book. I didn't know there were two other funding secure moments.
Oh, were there?
Yeah, at one point he announced that he had raised I think $40 million from investors, and he hadn't. And then a few years later at another liquidity crisis, he preemptively announced that the Department of Energy had agreed to give him a loan when they had.
Can't do that either.
And so none of the things he's done, in fact, when you go back, like all of the seeds of the things we've talked about happened in the early days of Tesla. Funding secured, production hell. He was in deep production hell for the Roadster.
Right.
He was in production hell for the Model S, deep production hell for the Model X at the time of the Model 3 reveal and Solar City and all that stuff, 2016. And then the whole gaslighting stuff. Like, he is just an amazing gaslighter. So gaslighting is when you basically accuse somebody else of doing exactly what you're doing in hopes to drive them crazy. So his response is to just gaslight. So if the answer is minus 100, he'll come out and say we're at plus 100.
Right.
If he's the worst manufacturer of automobiles in the world from a quality perspective, he'll come out and say we are the best manufacturer. If his cars crash at a much higher rate than most, our cars are the safest cars on the road. Like, whatever it is, he just negates it and then boldly states it.
It just goes back to the what I was saying before, which is, since I've been following this story intimately, which is 2.5 years maybe now, the one thing that seems to be a recurring theme to me is shoot now, promise now, deal with the consequences later, or figure out a way to do it later. And everything that we've seen, and I've talked about on past podcasts specifically, you know, the alien dreadnought, right? From the get-go, he was going to reinvent the way automobiles were assembled. He was going to reinvent the business model for auto manufacturers. He was going to do away with dealers. He had all of these disruptive ideas that really, after production was underway and the company came to fruition, didn't really seem like he had thought about any of them at all. He had all the ship, you know, all the shit shipped to Fremont to create this automated assembly line. And they wound up ripping all the shit out of Fremont and, yeah, you know, saying, well, we'll just bring people in instead.
Yeah.
It's like, shit, that's what everybody else has been doing.
And that's the genesis of Tesla Q. Like, I may have come from the solar angle, but the people that came from auto manufacturing,
right,
are, you know, and now Tesla Insurance, you know, suddenly he's going to be a better insurer than Geico. Okay.
Yeah, but that's another thing too, you know, where people were starting to get quotes. I was watching people posting quotes on Reddit and on Twitter. He came out and pitched, we're going to be offering insurance at 20 to 30% lower than everybody else, or whatever he said. And everybody that posted a quote, every single one that I saw, I didn't read one instance, and I read probably 10 to 15 people that had read, had applied, I guess, for a quote. All of them were 20 to 30% higher than their current insurance.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I don't know.
It's just,
why we drink, you know?
This is why we drink, or this is why I tweet. And sometimes I tweet when I drink, when I wish that I wouldn't. But it is what it is, you know. So if there's two things I would recommend your listeners to do if they've made it this far in the podcast, three things: drink beer, go back and watch the Solar City roof shingle reveal from October of 2016 on YouTube. It's a quick watch, 25 minutes. You'll be blown away. And then go buy Ed Niedermeyer's book, Ludicrous, so that you can get the full history of all of this and how we got here today. It does a very good job of the founding of Tesla and Elon's fight with the original founders and the lawsuit to proclaim himself as a co-founder, through the Roadster and taking customer deposits and using them for general corporate needs, which is, I think, illegal. This is a thing that's been repeated all the way through the Model 3. So there's no trick he's pulled today that he didn't learn he could get away with back then.
Right. Yeah. And
if
you get the hardcover version of the book too, then you have something to smash against your head after you finally figure out what the hell's going on.
So you get it against your head, but and say, why haven't I thought of the? You know, why don't I just go to the trial? I mean, that's actually the part that drives, I think, most Tesla Q crazy. If you gave me a stock tip of material confidential information, and I acted on it, the SEC would drop the hammer on me.
Sure,
And this guy gets to, you know, just make jokes out of the FTC, the SEC, the NHTSA, the NTSB, all of these government regulators that are supposed to look out for the little guy.
Right.
Are in fact just rolling over for the biggest of the big guys.
Right. Yeah. And I, you know, myself included, and all of the day traders that I know and people that, you know, I talk to every day on chat rooms when I'm trading or I'm looking at stuff, and guys that make their whole living doing this are obsessed with compliance and are obsessed with making sure that they can't, you know, that they don't accidentally even hear something in the wrong way, even if they're not even going to trade it. They just don't go there. Like, I can't tell you the number of phone conversations that I've had with people, or I've heard between people, where people are just stopping each other and be like, hey, you know what I think? God, don't tell me, you know, like people are so nervous about compliance, and people, you know, they want to come by it honestly, and they want to make sure that they're doing the right thing. And, you know, it's something that, you know, all of the traders that I surround myself with take seriously. It's something that I take seriously. I'm sure it's something that you take seriously. So when you think about that, and then you think about, well, here's this guy running what many people are alleging to be some type of scheme, and he's perversely violating those rules out in the open, right? He's just waving it in front of him, and he gets nothing. He gets a slap on the wrist, and that's what one of the things I think makes it truly offensive. And
it's just gaslighting writ large. And if you read Ed's book, and again, you know, so here's a perfect example. Ed is a son of an auto guy. He's an auto guy, works at an auto blog through the financial crisis, becomes a little suspicious of Elon, gets wind that Tesla is making customers sign non-disclosure agreements so they could replace defective suspension equipment,
the ball, joint sockets.
Yeah, wompy wheels, that whole nine yards. And has copies of these NDAs, and so he doesn't report on the suspension issues. He reports on the NDAs and how this might be an issue with the NHTSA, because actually that's not kosher. Consumers have to be allowed to complain to the NHTSA if their product has a defect. So his story, which is literally true, well-sourced, well-reported, like a professional reporter, basically says, hey, the NHTSA is investigating a series of non-disclosure agreements that Tesla's having its customer sign. Now, what's implied, of course, in the reporting is that there's an underlying suspension issue, but that's not what the reporting said. The reporting said there's these agreements. These agreements probably aren't kosher. The NHTSA is looking into it. Well, Elon via Tesla writes a blog basically accusing Ed Niedermeyer of fabricating the story and being a short. total gaslight. And to the point where Ed responded with a blog. This is all in the book, and it's all sort of relatively new to me. I was aware of it, but I didn't really read it. Basically, the title of his blog was Under Penalty of Perjury, where he basically says, I have no financial interest in Tesla. I've never been an investor. I've never shorted. None of what Tesla has accused me of being is true. And by the way, that blog post that I think smears Niedermeyer is still up today. You can go read it. It's on the Tesla homepage. So yep. There you go. So
that about covers it.
Indeed.
That about brings us to where we are. It's been a fascinating story, and I can't thank you enough for coming on and sharing your perspective and sharing your expertise. I appreciate it, and I hope people that, you know, listen to this got some new information from it, because I certainly did, and I've been following the story very closely. So my hope is people that have kind of funneled in from these last few podcasts that don't really even know what this podcast is about, maybe we change some perspectives today, but we'll see.
Yeah, you know? Maybe not. I mean, I doubt we'd change anybody who's already bullish, but and confirmed a lot of biases of Tesla Q. But to the people that are new to the story, maybe they learn a few things. And even if they didn't, you know what? It was fun. It's two people that like each other talking for an hour and 45 minutes. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, brother. So let's check back in a couple months at the next material development.
Indeed.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Appreciate it. See you.
All right. Take care. That was the one, the only Tesla Charts. The man himself. You want to follow him on Twitter? Here's a tough one to figure it out. It's at Tesla Charts. If you need help, take Midol for any headaches, any cramps, Tylenol for any headaches. For right now, it's 5:30. That was an awesome hour and a half, but at my old age, it's time for me to take a bathroom break and get on to my evening. I'm out of here. Peace!